Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlom. When you hear the word eggs, you most likely think of the dozen you buy at the grocery store to fry, scramble, or otherwise cook with. But consider that all animal life on Earth depends on eggs for reproduction, and it might dawn on you, as it did to our guest, that eggs are truly one of nature's most amazing success stories. Author Jules Howard, who joined us previously for an amazing episode about his book, Wonder Dog, has written a new book titled Infinite Life: The Revolutionary Story of Eggs, Evolution, and Life on Earth. And it's fascinating. From the very first biological structures that can be identified as eggs to modern animals, including human beings, the story of eggs is truly the story of life on our planet. The author joins us now from his home in London. Jules Howard, welcome once again to Blue Dot.
Thanks so much for having me back. This is a real pleasure.
Well, I really enjoyed this book. It was fascinating, but it really got me to thinking, like, what was it that made you, you know, there's the old question, we'll talk about that in a minute, but, you know, it made me think, what came first with Jules? Like, what was it that triggered this that made you want to investigate the story of eggs and evolution?
I suppose there's two ways of answering this. One is, I think I'm having a bit of a midlife crisis. I don't know if that's what you call it, you know, over there. But one of the things that I wanted to do was to write a book that I would have loved when I was younger. Just these massive soap operas, really, of evolution in terms of how animals, you know, moved onto the land and insects did their thing and diversified and all these familiar stories of evolution. I just love those as a younger reader when I was sort of early in my career. And I was like, well, eggs, you know, eggs is an ever-present thing for animal life. And actually, eggs have been shaped by evolution, by natural selection, in just the same ways that animal bodies have. So I kind of started thinking, like, you know, maybe there's a way to reframe the story of animal evolution from the perspective of eggs.
Of course, there's the old question, what came first, the chicken or the egg, which seems silly on the surface of it. But you have an interesting spin on that where you just kind of mentioned it. It's better to ask the question in a bit different way. Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. I think at the start of this process, I was kind of thinking, oh, that's almost a bit eye rolling about that question, you know, because we hear it so often. It's such a sort of familiar paradox. It's been around for, you know, since, you know, ancient Greeks were contemplating this problem of which came first. And I actually now think, having finished the book, I think it's just a great gateway question to ask, to sort of get science readers or people who think about science or like biology to actually sort of think carefully about what that question means. So by that, I mean, okay, look, the zoological answer to the, you know, which came first question is simply, eggs came first. You know, chickens, we think, looking at their DNA anyway, we can see pretty clearly they probably were domesticated about 10,000 years ago. They came from jungle fowl. So 10,000 years for chicken versus, you know, the shelled egg, the armored egg that chickens lay. Of course, that's a bird adaptation. Birds evolved from dinosaurs in the late Jurassic. So we're talking about a structure that evolved, you know, 150 million years ago. So chicken, 10,000 years, egg, or shelled egg, 150 million years. So in many ways, if, you know, chickens' eggs are fairly recent and birds' eggs go back, you know, all those millions of years, I suppose a different way of thinking about it is like, not, you know, which came first, chicken or egg, but which came first, the chicken or the egg tube? Because actually, these amazing tubes that birds use to produce their eggs, that's actually a really universal structure in animals. And that, you know, we see that egg tube in a lot of vertebrates, so bony animals, including fish. But we also see it in invertebrates too. You know, many insects use this same process, this egg tube or oviduct, which basically coats the egg and kind of gives it that kind of egg finish. So yeah, eggs, they are truly ancient.
Yeah, that's cool. Okay, well, let's talk about how ancient they are. Going back deep into the fossil record, Where's the earliest structure that we can identify as these are the first eggs that we have fossil evidence for?
Yeah, that's a great question. There are some very strange, weird fossils found in fossil beds in China. And these are about 600 million years old. And they, most scientists, not all, most scientists agree, you know, these were probably the first evidence of eggs that's in the fossil record. and they look like little grains of sand almost, like little miniature crystal globes almost. So these fossil eggs, 600 million years old, these are probably the earliest eggs that we know of. And what were they from? Well, that's another brilliant question that many scientists are still trying to grapple with, but probably like kind of jellyfish-like animals. So for a long period before there was animals as we know them, this was really an animal of like kind of jellyfish-like organisms, I suppose. So that's the earliest fossil evidence of eggs. But actually, when it comes to DNA, you know, you look at the genes that make sperm and by extension eggs, we think those genes go back probably about 1,000 million years ago. So we're talking long, long before chickens, long, long before bony animals. Like, in it, this is a world that we can only really imagine and may never turn up in the fossil record. So it's kind of amazing backstory to the egg, really.
It truly is. And got me thinking, it's so fascinating to think about how eggs and life on Earth has evolved over time. And you make some really interesting points throughout the book that, you know, we tend to think of these things happening. There's, you know, some kind of magic moment or, you know, Goldilocks moment in time. But, you know, really, all of these things are shaped by immense amounts of time and changes going on with the Earth, you know. Climate change, for one thing, volcanism, plate tectonics, impacts from outer space, you know, so many things constantly happening, you know, reshaping life on Earth, and then the eggs adapting to that. You want to maybe address that a bit?
You know, I wasn't expecting to feel that when I started the book, but that's definitely the feeling that I've got now looking back on it, is that it is absolutely extraordinary how much the actual planet, our place in the solar system, affects and has affected eggs and how they've evolved and adapted. So the one I think about this all the time, but like the one that really surprised me was that in the Carboniferous, so this is 300, 400 million years ago, it was a very humid climate, particularly, you know, around the equator, you know, very thick, humid rainforests or early rainforests. And the climate changed, and slowly but surely those wetter habitats became incredibly dry. And we see from that process, we start to see the evolution of two different groups of animals evolving the same feature. And that is a kind of waterproof coating for the egg. So one of these groups is insects. So insects used to be kind of also-rans to spiders and other groups. And then they evolve these incredible sort of breathable suit of armor for the egg called the serosa. And it was after that point you start to see insects really diversify. And traditionally I was always taught, you know, insects diversified because they evolved wings. But in the book I argue, you know, insects evolved wings, but, you know, they couldn't have got very far evolutionarily, you know, without this important adaptation to kind of weatherproof their egg for drier climates. And then we see the same invertebrates as well. So on land, these, you know, land fish, but essentially early reptiles and amphibians, you know, were evolving a new type of egg. So reptiles especially, this new egg was kind of more hard wearing. It had like special compartments, like breathable compartments to get rid of waste and to absorb more oxygen for the growing embryo. So that egg is called the amniotic egg. And in fact, that was one of the adaptations, I argue, that really led to the kind of push forward, if you like, of the reptile group. So, you know, without the amniotic egg, we wouldn't have dinosaurs, we wouldn't have birds, we wouldn't have crocodiles. And as a side branch of that, we wouldn't have mammals either. So, yeah, I mean, these features that we kind of take for granted in the modern age, in insects and in, you know, bony land animals, these were kind of carved and crafted due to this intense period of climate change that occurred, you know, 300, 400 million years ago.
Well, let's talk about the fish. There's a really interesting thing in your book early on, where you're talking about the Devonian period back in there, where the age of the fishes, as they say, mm-hmm. on when you see the geologic timescale. And there's a story of the mother fish. Could you tell us about that? Because I found that to be really interesting.
Yeah, it took me back to the biology textbook. So here in Britain, I just got a memory of looking at biology textbooks and seeing, you know, this feature, you know, the placenta, the umbilical cord, the human baby, you know, the embryo growing. and thinking that was a really unique thing, it was a very human thing that we should celebrate. And of course, it's very impressive and worthy of celebration. But that thing, that umbilical cord, that placenta, is not a uniquely human thing, not even a uniquely mammal thing. So the first evidence we have of that, of embryos kind of strapped up to the wall of the egg tube, comes from fish about 420 million years ago. So this is an incredible fossil discovered in Australia a few years back. And you can actually see, for ages, they didn't even realize, you know, there was baby fish within the bigger fish fossil, if that makes sense. But careful analysis of this beautiful fish, you could see not just little fossils of embryos within it, but also tiny thread-like umbilical cords linked to those embryos within the mother fish's body. So absolutely staggering to find a fossil with such sort of complexity intact, but a really beautiful fossil that suggests that, you know, it, that, you know, that fish wasn't even in our lineage. It wasn't even in the land fish lineage. It was a bunch of armored fish called placoderms that had evolved this feature. So yeah, absolutely extraordinary. And we see this, I mean, I call the placenta in the book a sort of hungry umbilical cord. So, you know, essentially the embryo devours all of its yolk, which travels into the body through the umbilical cord. And then the umbilical cord kind of goes rogue and starts looking to attach to the egg tube, or, you know, the oviduct, and basically drain the mother of resources. So we see all sorts of weird adaptations among fish, including sharks today, where, you know, the uterine wall of a lot of sharks can kind of produce milk that sort of dribbles out of it. And then the hungry umbilical cord, you know, gets to work on this milk that the mother produces. And it's all going on in the dark, you know, mere centimetres beneath the shark's skin. I'm aware that when I talk about this book, I sound like I'm having some sort of fever dream. Because some of the concepts, I mean, the concepts are, you know, obviously scientific and like evolutionarily amazing. But like sometimes when you're talking about this process of egg production, it sounds even weird to me, almost, having read so much about animal evolution, to talk in such weird depth, I suppose, about these weird egg tubes and what they're doing in animals' bodies.
And there's just so much to cover because, you know, you do in a relatively short book, in a very entertaining way, you kind of cover the evolution of eggs through the history of life on Earth, which is pretty amazing. One of the things that struck me reading this, and I was aware of this in the past from, you know, just my own background, is that we don't really realize that by studying these fossils, you know, we learn these amazing things. And so many of these discoveries, you know, like I saw in your book, are relatively recent. We'll talk about the dinosaur eggs later. But it's very difficult for something to become a fossil. A fossil is totally the exception rather than the rule.
Absolutely. And I heard someone, this is one of those figures that I should probably check before saying out loud, but I heard someone say the other day, something like the chances of something fossilizing, just a random eggshell fossilizing, is about something like 1 in 1 million or 1 in 5 million. I mean, incredibly unlikely, because even though eggshell is quite hard, of course, eggshell gets, you know, denatured. It gets washed into rivers and streams, smashed into tiny pieces, eaten. So yeah, most eggshells we will never see. And of course, the eggshells that are fossilized, really the only ones that fossilize well are the ones with hard shells, i.e. the shells of birds and some reptiles. So yeah, it is. I mean, that's the joy of fossil hunting, isn't it? You know, like they're out there. The chances are slim for certain animals and for certain types of, you know, adaptations. But like anyone stands a chance just by looking. Do you know what I mean? It's a really, that's genuinely one of the sort of big thrills about fossil hunting. It's a bit of a lottery.
Yeah. And if you find something, you know, you're getting these just fleeting glimpses into the story of life on Earth. And, you know, whether or not they give you some tremendous insights or not, you know, that's another story altogether. So, but it is interesting to consider, you know, how much we have been able to tease out from the fossil record to look at this incredible pageant of life on Earth and the changes it's undergone through time. The other thing that, you know, people have a hard time wrapping their heads around geologic time in general, but, you know, when you look at the classic geologic time scale, you know, it kind of shows you the Precambrian as if like, oh, that's a chunk. And then it goes into all the detail stuff with life on Earth, because that's when the fossils start to show up. That's when you get, you know, the Cambrian explosion and the Devonian and the Carboniferous and on and on and on. But if you look at, you know, the actual time period that was what we call Precambrian or Archean, whatever you want to call it, that is an immense span of time compared to the time where we really have a fossil record.
Yeah, I know. And it, I mean, there's that great analogy, isn't there, about the, you know, the clock or something, is it, you know, 24-hour clock, and animals really only get going, you know, if the planet starts at 12 o'clock, you know, midnight, then animals really get going in that last kind of 9 o'clock at night or something like that. So for 9 hours of that imaginary day, as you say, there's tides coming in, there's volcanic eruptions, there's continents moving, there's cataclysmic, you know, kind of atmospheric events. And all the while, these tiny microorganisms are, you know, doing their thing, and natural selection's kind of carving away at them and chipping away at them. I think one of the, for me, one of the key events, if you like, in the story of eggs is the, you know, this impact that happened, you know, within the first few 100 million years of Earth existing, I guess, as a place, this big impact with a body called Theia, a bit like a, you know, almost about the size of Mars, we think.
That forms the moon.
Yeah, it forms the moon. And you have this big gravity ripping object in our orbit and essentially pulling tides back and forth, but also, you know, that big explosion knocking the Earth off its axis and giving us a kind of wonky spin that gives us seasons. And, you know, in the book, I argue that actually that seasonal change probably was a driving factor in the earliest eggs, you know, seasonal change when there's suddenly food is not abundant. Animals need a way to kind of let their genes time travel forwards in time to when the good times are back, when the resources are back, when there's food to eat. So for me, I don't know, if there was life on other planets, I would be interested to know, you know, whether those planets without moons evolved a structure like an egg, or, you know, exactly what it'd be so interesting, wouldn't it, to see the impact on organisms that having a moon or having different shapes or sized moons would have on the corresponding life.
Yes, I know a lot of scientists involved in the search for extraterrestrial life. And, you know, sometimes they make the point that, you know, we may not even recognize it as being alive if it's really different from what we're used to, you know, life that has evolved on Earth, which has essentially all got the same DNA.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, such a wonderful area of science, isn't it? Lovely. I mean, in some ways, it's a bit like the fossils thing, you know, that this information's out there and it's something we can all be involved in searching for and discovering. So, fantastic.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with author Jules Howard as we discuss his new book, Infinite Life, The Revolutionary Story of Eggs, Evolution, and Life on Earth. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's return now to our conversation about the role of eggs in the evolution of life on Earth with science author Jules Howard. You mentioned the amniotic egg, and you even have the title of a chapter. It's called A Most Marvelous Invention. You could just talk about what an incredible invention the amniotic egg was.
Yeah, it's... I think in the book I called it a kind of, most eggs are like a hotel room for the embryo, but this amniotic egg is a hotel room that has, you know, a bathroom attached, it has a little kitchenette, there's a little waste disposal unit, the windows open and close, there's a security guard on the, you know, in front of the door. So, you know, it's a uniquely adapted structure, essentially a combination of membranous bags. You know, so one of these bags is very important for collecting oxygen that diffuses into the egg. Another of these bags is very important for getting rid of waste. There's even a little chamber. In fact, when you boil an egg, you see this little chamber. I don't know if you've ever noticed it on the top of it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, this little... I didn't know about it before writing this book, and I think about it every single boiled egg sandwich I have. I go, oh, yeah, there it is. This little hollow section at the top of the egg.
I had never realized what that really, that was really a special thing until I read your book. And then I started thinking, oh yeah, there's always that little space at the base of the egg where there's air, and it's got that, it's like, well, it's almost, at first you think, well, how come this egg didn't fill in, you know, the entire shell?
Yeah.
It's there for a reason.
Yeah, absolutely. And every bird you've ever walked past or listened to or noticed in your life, its first breath was that chamber of air. So the chick uses that little chamber of air to sort of take in its first breath, giving it the energy to then punch its beak through the shell and begin its life. So unbelievably amazing, incredible structure. But, you know, it goes back to what you said before, like these are such long timescales. It's tempting to look at the amniotic egg and think, oh, blimey, that is seriously, you know, that is almost intelligent, you know. But actually, you know, the timescales here are, we're talking 50 million years or so. So this is if in some ways to me, that speaks to the amount of cataclysms going on in the Carboniferous, you know, the amount of sort of selective agents going on, mostly to do with weather, storm, and as I said before, this upward rising, drying temperature, I guess. But yeah, it's also amazing to think these were soil structures as well. That also amazed me, you know, is that eggs back then were like seeds, really. We think most of them were laid, you know, in soil, you know, that these were creatures of the soil. No such thing as nests, as far as we know back then. These were, you know, planted like seeds in the ground, which again is just extraordinary and not what I expected to discover at all.
And it's also interesting to think about, you mentioned the land fishes, the fish that started to occupy the land, that there's a driving force in change going on there. And one of the interesting things that I read in your book that I'd never really considered was you kind of hypothesized that it may be that these fish were trying to lay their eggs in shallower water and puddles and places they could possibly get to avoid the big predators that are out in the open water.
Yeah. And we see that strategy in a number of coastal rock pool fish. We also see it in amphibians. So some of the most cosmopolitan frogs that are out there literally specialize in newer ponds. So ponds and puddles essentially that are only seasonal. So seasonal ponds are really good because they don't have many predators in them. You can't have a population of fish living there for years on end. So it may well be that the same selection pressures that frogs, for instance, go through, or these rock pool fish, that actually some of them, these tiny little blennies they're called, and they will actually lay their eggs within cracks, you know, on the wet sides of wave swept rocks. So again, like when you're dealing with this constant drying environment, it kind of in some ways it looks like it's drawing animals out. Of course it's not doing that. It's not like these fish are crawling out and like, wow, we're just hitting upon discovering this new technique. Really, the evolution of eggs on land is probably the story written in billions, in fact trillions, of eggs that dried out, and the survivors are the ones that continue that sort of genetic lineage, that relay race, I suppose, into the next phase of evolution, I guess. So yeah, it's a strategy that I think we do see in animals today, particularly fish. I think there's more than 10 different species of fish that walk, move, lay their eggs quite ably on land. And obviously, you know, this is a tradition that goes back 420 million years ago, right back to those early land fishes, as you say.
Well, one of the things I found really interesting and appropriate for me is I'm a fly fisherman, I'm an angler, and I enjoy figuring out what's going on with the aquatic bug life that my trout are feeding on and trying to figure out if I can fool them into taking a fly. But it's fascinating to think about the insects, especially, you know, early on, they go through, they have some very different strategies where they have these, you know, larval stages and pupae and then metamorphosis and all that. It's really quite astonishing.
Yeah. And, you know, funnily enough, I mentioned earlier on how it amazed me that the amniotic egg and the insect egg kind of evolved at the same time, roughly, due to the same environmental influences. And in some ways, the adaptation of insects to have this larval stage is also, weirdly, it's mirrored in mammals through marsupials. So I'll explain what I mean by that. Essentially, you have about roughly 300 or so million years ago, we have some sort of event where insects are laying their eggs, and some of those eggs hatch early due to a mutation that we see in some insect eggs today. And essentially, the organism that climbs out of that hatched egg is a wriggling embryo, I guess you could call it, you know, so it's a worm-like embryo. And crucially, its mouth parts differ from those of adults. So those early, let's call them maggots, okay, it's going to really annoy any fly scientists listening, but we're going to call them all maggots. But yeah, those early maggots essentially hit upon eating a different food source to adults. And then their development continues, they turn into adults, and those adults eat something different. And why that seems to work so well in insects, I mean, that adaptation has seen insects thrive. It's something like 75 or 80% of insects today have a maggot in their life cycle. And essentially, we think that's because, you know, if babies are going around eating a different food source to their adult counterparts, you can kind of double the numbers of individuals within a habitat, because there's, you know, kind of twice the food. So that process in insects leads to a kind of larvae, if you like. But in marsupials, we see something sort of similar. I mean, have you ever seen in our sex education classes, right? And when I was younger, we used to, I don't know why, but we were always shown videos of like mammal births, but also videos of marsupial births. Have you ever seen a little marsupial birth?
You described this in your book, the story of, was it the red kangaroo or something like that? And I know I've never seen that, but tell us about that movie, because you could tell it definitely had an impact on you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's sort of, I'm not sure it was for the best, but yeah, essentially, you know, the video that we were shown, it shows this. Honestly, it looks like a jelly baby. So, you know, a little tiny maggot-like organism climbs out of the female's reproductive passageway and then kind of crawls. It's got kind of, weirdly, it's actually got quite strong arms. So it's like a maggot with a pair of arms, essentially. Crawls up the female's underside and climbs up. Even though it's tiny, it barely has a brain. It manages to work out which way is up. It can even follow the smell of the pouch. So this tiny maggot-like mammal organism heads up and moves into the pouch, where it finds a teat, and it obviously essentially grabs onto the teat and it can't let go. So it's locked on for months on end, and that's where it continues its development. Now, the key thing in terms of adaptations, we think, is that by doing that, that frees up the female to get pregnant and start the process of, you know, beginning on a new embryo. So just like I said, insects could, by having a baby life stage and an adult life stage, could kind of thrive with double the potential. It's the sort of similar sort of thing with mammals, really, with marsupials, where, you know, if a kangaroo, an early kangaroo, is living in an environment without much food, then it can produce more babies, if you like, in that environment by having one sort of in the fridge, I was going to say, one in the oven and one on the kitchen side, let's say. So again, these adaptations and features that we think are unique to one group of animals, when it comes to eggs, we see them in different groups, if that makes sense, which I still find fascinating.
Another thing I found interesting is when we think of kangaroos, we think of their massive hind legs, is that those aren't very developed at all. In the little creature you're describing that crawls up mom and has to do this, you know, kind of heroic climb. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, the climb is extraordinary. So the embryos, as you say, all marsupial embryos are basically a pair of ripped arms and a maggot-like body. They barely have enough skin to keep water within the body. So these are really, really very delicate, very sensitive walking embryos, essentially. And what's unique about marsupials is that seems to be so hardwired into their genetic blueprint that it has affected the evolution of mammal shapes as a whole. So in other words, a lot of scientists have always had this big mystery: where are the marsupial whales? Where are the marsupial bats? You know, why did so many forms of marsupials evolve to look like their mammalian counterparts? You know, but why aren't they swimming? Why aren't they flying? And essentially, it's, most scientists kind of agree, it's probably because, you know, they are stuck with this embryonic body shape that requires that they are climbers, essentially. So once they've got this early shape to their embryo. They don't seem to be able to evolve, a waterborne form, which is kind of cool and interesting. And also the pouch as well. There is one marsupial, I think it's called the water opossum, and it does enter the water, and it has a pouch with a sort of elastic drawstring almost, so it can close, and it's backwards pointing as well, so the babies don't drown. But it seems like, you know, marsupials have been really constrained by this early part of their life cycle. And in fact, in the book, I argue that, you know what, without that weird marsupial life cycle, we probably wouldn't have the even stranger mammals that we call platypus and echidna. So these are famously the egg-laying mammals. And yeah, in the book, I argue that, you know, platypus, those early platypus, which were evolving 50 million years or so ago, probably had the run of the pools and the ponds and the lakes, because marsupials couldn't evolve to take over that domain. So these animals are all interlinked. Their reproductive strategies are all kind of connected to one another. So yeah, like I said at the very start of our conversation, really, like, this is a soap opera, and it's a soap opera written in egg tubes, essentially.
Well, and speaking of soap operas, they generally revolve around sex. And reading the book got me to thinking about this too. It's like, there are a lot of life forms on Earth that do not depend on sex to reproduce the next generation. And it's just, it's interesting to consider what were the things that triggered this incredible dance between sperm and egg that, you know, is sexual reproduction in animals.
It is one of the most attractive and kind of almost weirdest questions about animal evolution going. We think it happened about 1,000 million years ago, and animals back then essentially were single celled, and they were motoring around. You still see animals like this in ponds. If you ever look with a microscope, they're incredible. They buzz around in ponds. But actually what that process was, what it looked like for them to start their journey towards the evolution of eggs and sperm is, I wonder if we'll ever know. I mean, I'm hoping we will find out the answer to that. But I do wonder if it's one of those mysteries we may never get to see. And most ideas out there are kind of like that sperm is a stupendously evolved parasitic form of genetic vessel, and essentially uses, you could say, I'm using quotations here, but uses the larger cell, which we're going to call female in this case, as an avenue for genetic exchange. And at first, those parasitic males, which I guess is what I'm saying, you know, we're going around and kind of exploiting, if you like, the larger female cells as a way to sort of, you know, house their DNA. But over time, this became a kind of strategy that worked. You know, essentially, you have one heavier item is the egg, which is where the embryo is going to form. And you have one devious heat-seeking missile, if you like, which is the sperm. And, you know, the uniqueness of that arrangement leads to, you know, where we are now, where animals are kind of dependent on sperm and eggs. But I am just going to correct myself there, because I was doing that thing that I think we always do, and you sort of have this vision of sperm. Do you remember a film? This is slightly off topic, but let's go with it, if that's okay. Do you remember a film called Look Who's Talking?
Vaguely.
It was a comedy film from the 80s.
I vaguely remember it as a comedy.
And it was like the babies could speak or something
right.
like that. The first scene is the sperm entering. They're like little cartoon characters almost. And they're entering the vagina and swimming up the uterus. And they're all like, hey, guys, let's go. And in fact, I remember it because I rewatched it. They are singing, the Beach Boys is playing, and they're all like, everybody go dance. And they're all swimming through the passage, these sort of frat boys, I guess you might call them. And they hit the egg, and the egg's just like this big sort of bulbous heavenly body, if you like. And they're all like trying to push their way through. Actually, that is a bit of a false description, I guess, of what is going on. You know, sperm, through stuff like that we see in the media, I think we do think of sperm being quite intrepid and searching out eggs, and eggs doing very little. But in fact, you know, the egg is incredibly well adapted. You know, it produces a kind of swathe of chemicals that draw the sperm in. Essentially, they alter the way that the sperm's tail flickers so that the sperm is kind of directed towards the egg. And in fact, as soon as the sperm connects with the egg kind of has these fireworks really that travel across the surface of the egg and stopping other sperm from getting in. And that process, essentially, it used to be that I think people used to imagine the sperm was like giving everything and pushing itself through the cell wall of the egg. But in fact, the cell's basically sort of falling apart, and the egg is doing all it can to sort of cradle and pull this pretty small, pathetic cell, you know, the sperm cell within it. So, I mean, that was another, I've never really written about kind of chemistry or structures so small in nature, but I was really surprised at just how adaptive that single cell is.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll continue our look at how eggs have shaped the evolution of life on Earth with Jules Howard. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our look at eggs and the evolution of life on Earth with author Jules Howard as we talk about his new book, Infinite Life. Let's talk about mammals a bit, because one of the things I found really interesting was, you know, when we think about the Jurassic Park films, you know, they're all about the dinosaurs. But you devote a lot of time in the Jurassic period in your book to the earliest mammals, and they were creatures of the night, weren't they?
Yeah, and I think that we could probably tell the story of Jurassic animals a bit better if we, you know, didn't spend quite as much time thinking of the dinosaurs. Dinosaurs clearly, you know, the larger ones shaped their ecosystems and environments just like large mammals do today, just like megafauna does today. But essentially, the niche, what you call it, niche, don't you, over there? The sort of domain, if you like, of mammals, it does seem to have been constrained by these, you know, world-changing organisms that we call dinosaurs. So what does that mean? That essentially means that most mammals, we think, evolved into creatures of the night, I guess you could say. So at night, obviously, temperatures are cooler. We see the proliferation of adaptations for keeping heat within the body. So hair, you know, what we call warm-bloodedness, but essentially, you know, variable body temperature we can manipulate and keep the way we want it to. And also features like whiskers, you know, to help us move around at night. And obviously a really highly attuned sense of smell. And also to a degree, really good night vision. So these are features that we see genetically, you know, we see the genes for across all mammals today, including, by the way, whiskers. You know, humans, you know, 50% of humans have muscles to work whiskers that are no longer there. So this is a really big part of the mammal story. And essentially, these are all, each one of them features for utilizing that nighttime realm. But when it comes to eggs and the way that mammals employ their eggs, of course, that's another feature, you know. So cold temperatures, we see this in lizards and some snakes today, you know, cold places, populations of some lizards that live on mountainsides frequently evolve, even within the last, you know, 100 years, can evolve to keep the eggs within the body, within the egg tube, where the temperature's controlled and, you know, weather events aren't going to break or destroy the eggs. So that's the same pattern that we would have seen in those early mammals, keeping the embryos within the body, losing the eggshell, and essentially evolving, I was going to say parasitic embryos, but it is a bit like that. You know, we're talking about embryos that can hook themselves up to their mothers and essentially ply their mother for their energetic needs, you know. So, yeah, these are features, again, crafted, carved, whittled, whatever you want to call it, you know, features that evolved in that world of dinosaurs.
Well, in that world of dinosaurs, there's something very interesting that is a relatively new discovery I discovered from your book, is egg coloration in dinosaur eggs. And could you just briefly talk a bit about what are the advantages to having colorized, artistic-looking eggs?
They really are artistic, I agree. So these eggs, they look like almost like a marbled coloration, swirling patterns, a bit like clouds on some of them. And the chemicals that found in fossils, so this includes fossils of Velociraptor eggs, The chemicals found within those fossils line up with those that we see in birds today. So particularly two chemicals. One of them is the chemical that makes, you know, when you get a bruise and the bruise goes blue. So it's that, funnily enough, it's the same chemical that causes that process. So the blue we see in our bruises is the same blue that we see in many different species of wild birds today. So yeah, the colours, what do they mean? So for a long time, scientists thought bird egg, particularly bird eggs, that colour is about camouflage, or it's a way to, you know, fight off radiation from the sun, and lots of different vying ideas for like 100 years or so. But scientists at the moment think, you know, this is actually a feature to help mothers recognise their own eggs. So the first thing a female bird does when the egg is laid is checks it out. She will look at it. She will sort of identify it, look at the features of it, check it's healthy. But crucially, it seems that they kind of memorize the patterns on their eggs. And that means if there are cuckoo-like, you know, birds around, so birds that lay their eggs in other nests, it means the female can more quickly identify the eggs of, you know, parasitic brood stealers, I guess you could call them. So that feature, we don't know if dinosaurs had kind of cuckoo dinosaur species. But the fact that we see these same colours employed in the same patterns sometimes, these swirling patterns, suggests to a lot of paleontologists that, you know what, birds and dinosaurs, this is very much a part of their lifestyles. You know, their nests all over the place. There are opportunities for parasites to lay their own eggs. And, you know, what do we see? We see birds kind of adapting. We see dinosaurs potentially adapting in just the same way. I mean, one of the, you mentioned Jurassic Park there. I think about this all the time. I love the Jurassic Park movies. I really do. Even though, you know, I have slightly mixed feelings about some of the late ones, but we won't talk about that. But I do think one of the things is missing from our narrative of like what it was like, the world of dinosaurs, is this, the egg story. You know, like birds in spring, especially, they go kind of crazy. They go calcium crazy for a while. You know, female birds need, sometimes they need more than their own body weight in calcium just to produce enough eggshell. And they're getting that calcium from snails. They're getting it sometimes from even brick mortar. I've seen birds, you know, picking away at brick mortar and gravel, essentially trying to get as much calcium as they can within the body to produce those eggshells. And I honestly think in a world of dinosaurs, during the day at least, so much egg-laying activity must have been going on that dinosaurs must have been frantically looking for calcium in just the same way we see with birds. And the amount of nests there must have been, and the amount of opportunities for eating and stealing and killing embryos and all sorts else. I honestly think that would be a big part of the dinosaur seasons, but we don't really see that. We see a lot of dinosaurs sort of standing in silhouette, screaming into the sky, but we don't see many egg-laying stuff. So I'm hoping this book might change that.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about, you know, that frantic activity that mother birds go through. And the same thing was probably going on with those types of dinosaurs, because, you know, birds are dinosaurs. They've evolved from that, the same type as the Tyrannosaurus rex and velociraptors. Those types of dinosaurs became the birds, and there were birds back then. So it's very interesting to think about those eggs and the colors and all of it. It's just fascinating. And of course, you know, one of the things that drives evolution and the story of life on Earth are these cataclysmic times of great dying, the worst one being the Permian, the end of the Permian, when most life on Earth goes extinct. But that kind of wipes the slate clean in a way for new forms to take place. And then when you discuss this a bit, you know, this is also the time when the supercontinent Pangaea is breaking apart. It's doing that. And so you've got these separate land masses. The astonishing variety of mammals that just blossoms right after the time of the dinosaurs, you know, relatively soon in geologic time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what I find interesting, and again, I contemplate this quite a lot, is at first, as you say, the slate, you know, is wiped clean by that giant meteorite, and mammals and birds both able to produce a lot of babies quite quickly compared to dinosaurs. You know, we think a dinosaur embryo took about 3 months to hatch. Birds, it's like 3 weeks. So mammals and birds can populate, you know, the landscape, the continents much more quickly, perhaps, than many of their dinosaur competitors. So we see them kind of inherit the world. It's just one fluky event, one big rock from space, you know, it's amazing. really, really is amazing when you think about, like, that was one day essentially that changed everything. But yeah, for 20 million years at the start of this new age of mammals, let's call it, we see mammals adapting in lots of different ways, some becoming carnivores, omnivores, herbivores, etc. But their brains stay kind of relatively small. Their skulls, if you like, aren't really domed. They're very, I was going to say rat-like, but that's not really fair on rats. But essentially, you know, I would say semi-primitive compared to today's mammals. And it's almost like, and there's some fantastic scientists at the Natural History Museum in London working on this problem, it's almost like mammals, there were so many mammals around suddenly that those with the most impressive brains, if you like, who are adaptable and can employ different strategies in different situations, begin to flourish. So we see the evolution of larger brains mammals, particularly in the kind of carnivore, cat-like, dog-like arena, but also in, of course, the lineage that becomes monkeys and apes especially. And what that brings new problems, because the bigger the brain, the more energy, you know, is required to produce it. And brains, so expensive, our most expensive organ by far. So you have these early mammals evolving bigger brains, having more energetic needs to make babies. And the babies themselves are evolving a more sort of bloodthirsty placenta to acquire more nutrients from mother. And we get this kind of, particularly in the ape and later the human lineage, we kind of get this crazy runaway evolution, essentially, where, the energetic needs of the embryo become all-encompassing, essentially. So we see this pattern, I suppose, in humans especially, you know, of the female body adapting to sort of push back on the ravaging needs of the embryo. And one of the ways it does that, of course, is by making the lining of the uterus that bit thicker. So we see that in humans. We see it in a couple of other monkey and ape lineages as well. But essentially, we end up with a situation where it's menstruation is the only game in town. In other words, shedding the lining of the uterus, you know, this protection, if you like, against this invasive embryo is the most effective means, I suppose, of keeping the embryo kind of in its place. So mammals like that, I think if aliens visited Earth, that would be one of the areas they'd be very interested in, is, you know, mammals are one of the big groups of animals that are connected to their embryos in a way that other animals are not. So we see these evolutionary struggles going on between mother and daughter. And that is very much a feature we see in this modern age, the Cenozoic, you know, the age of mammals.
Yes. And of course, you know, that also, when you think about how hard pregnancy is on the human body and on a woman, there really is kind of this uneasy truce going on between the child inside and the mom.
I agree. And, you know, we see in some pregnancies, of course, we see cases of high blood pressure where the embryo is basically tinkering with the blood pressure of the adult and, you know, pumping more oxygen-rich blood the embryo's way. And as you say, many complications of pregnancy have evolved because, as you say, that's a great way of putting it, an uneasy truce, you know, and we don't see the same level of uneasiness evolutionarily with other primate groups. It seems very much to be a challenge that humans have had to overcome. And of course, it leads to, you know, not just menstruation, but also menopause, which is, you know, vanishingly rare among mammals. You know, some orca undergo menopause. I think orangutans do. But essentially, we're talking about a relationship with the embryo that's so kind of toxic that it's better for adults to only produce eggs for a limited time and extend their life so that they can be there as grandmas, I suppose. And this menopause and the evolution of the grandma effect, I guess you could call it, another really fascinating insight into what it is to be human, I guess, what it is to be part of this one stick on the end of this crazy ape family tree, I guess.
Well, we're about out of time, but before we let you go, I just as briefly as you can, ponder on the future of eggs on Earth.
Yeah, that's a really good question. In the book, I tell a story of these really strange ocean-living insects. They're a bit like pond skaters, that, you know, these insects you see skating on the surface of the water, and they live out at sea, really far out. And they've developed a habit in recent years of laying their eggs on plastic, floating bottles, you know, the stuff that unfortunately gets blown into the sea. And that's a kind of tragic tale. But a bit of me is like, you know, eggs will adapt. Some species will do rather well out of climate change. Some species will do well out of these awful, tragic things that humanity is doing to our planet. But my overriding feeling is that there are going to be some species that do not do well. But the main thing I think as a sort of science writer is I'm really attracted to the idea that we keep our museums in brilliant health, because museum eggshell collections are just so good. They're just so amazing. So eggshell collections are really important, obviously, because you can compare, you know, how eggs are changing compared to eggs that were collected, you know, 200 or 150 years ago. So, you know, of course, Silent Spring, you know, the use of DDT and the effect that had on bird eggshells, you know, that we couldn't have understood that if we didn't have access to good museum collections. So if there's a rallying cry in the book, it's that we need to sort of value museum collections much more and value the scientists that use them to help work out how eggs, how animal populations, if you like, are going to be affected by things like pollution, by things like climate change.
Well, Jules Howard, author of Infinite Life, the revolutionary story of eggs, evolution, and life on Earth, thanks for joining us once again on Blue Dot.
Honestly, total pleasure. I'm such a fan, so thanks very much for having me. Real privilege.
Thanks again to our guest, science author Jules Howard. His new book, Infinite Life, The Revolutionary Story of Eggs, Evolution, and Life on Earth, is published by Pegasus Books and available at most major booksellers or order it from your local bookstore. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Cap Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.